From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. John Adams' opera Nixon in China combined minimalism and recent politics. On this edition of Fresh Air, Adams tells us about his new composition, The Wound Dresser, his setting for Walt Whitman's poem about nursing wounded soldiers during the Civil War. Also today, we're off to the place where scores of comics got their start, New York's Catskill Mountains. Stephen Canfer has written a history of the Catskills and their celebrated resort hotels. Rock historian Ed Ward concludes his look back at rock 10 years ago, when we entered the 80s. And book critic John Leonard reviews Good Night by Soviet novelist Andrei Sinyavsky. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. East German President Manfred Gerlach today said the Berlin Wall is superfluous and will eventually be dismantled. East German officials previously have suggested the barrier would be retained, at least in part, to prevent smuggling and the spread of drugs as well as other social problems. Visiting Czechoslovak President Václav Havel said today that Gerlach said that dismantling the wall has already begun, referring to more than 24 crossings punched through it in the past 2 months. Cleanup of a gasoline spill in a river near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, continues today after a fuel barge broke loose and ruptured yesterday. But environmental officials say the drinking water is safe. John Boyle of member station WDUQ in Pittsburgh reports.
Ice jams on the Monongahela River near Pittsburgh caused 53 barges to break loose from their moorings on the river. One of the barges ruptured, spilling 10,000 gallons of unleaded gasoline into the river. State Department of Environmental Resources spokeswoman says at no time was any water supply in any damage, and there was no contamination of any water sent to customers. However, two water authorities did stop pumping from the river for a few hours overnight until the spill passed their intake valves. Crews tried to recover as much fuel as possible from the river, and officials say they'll allow the remainder of the gas to disperse in the water. For National Public Radio, this is John Boyle in Pittsburgh.
A Moroccan news agency said today a 150-mile oil slick is now about 20 miles off the coast and is likely to wash ashore in the next 24 hours. Morocco says about 19 million gallons of crude have spewed from an Iranian supertanker. A salvage firm said two leaking chambers of the tanker had emptied. The human rights organization Amnesty International has accused the Israeli government of encouraging the killing of Palestinians to put down the uprising or intifada. John Dyer reports from London.
The Amnesty International report says that the Israeli government has condoned and even encouraged executions without trial in an attempt to control the two-year-old intifada. Amnesty claims that the evidence for this is contained in the guidelines for the use of firearms by Israeli forces. The human rights organization says that these guidelines are not clear on how serious an offense must be for firearms to be used. Since September 1989, soldiers have been able to treat masked people as suspect and use live ammunition to arrest them. Amnesty claims that over 560 Palestinians have been shot dead by Israeli forces since the uprising began. It says that about 130 of these were under the age of 16. An Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman has described the report as an outrageous accusation that's total nonsense and absolutely baseless. For National Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Dyer in London.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 57 points today to close at 28.10.15. Advances led declines 3-1. This is NPR News. Government radio in Nicaragua reported today that U.S.-backed rebels killed two nuns, one of them an American, in an attack in the northeastern part of the country. Voice of Nicaragua identified the dead American nun as Maureen Courtney. Radio said an American bishop, Paul Schmitz, and a Nicaraguan nun and a priest were also wounded in the attack in an isolated region of a province in the northeast part of the country. The Bush administration announced today it will not make the January 22nd deadline for submitting a fiscal 1991 budget. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
Budget Director Richard Darman wrote a letter to House and Senate leaders apologizing for what he said would be a one-week delay. He pointed out that budgets have been late many times before. In a letter to House Speaker Thomas Foley, Darman acknowledged that there is concern about the delay from Senator James Sasser, chairman of the Budget Committee. Darman insisted that the Bush administration simply could not deliver its first full-year budget by January 22nd, but that it would be ready by January 29th. He said the budget would be late primarily because the appropriations bills and the budget-cutting bill were late in 1989. Congress passed the budget-cutting measure just before it began the Christmas and New Year's holiday recess. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
The first uninjured U.S. troops to return after 2 weeks in Panama arrived at their home base in California today. 56 soldiers arrived in the first contingent back to Fort Ord. A second group of 41 is expected later. The United States today announced the release of $70 million in frozen assets to Panama's new government and said a high-level team sent to Panama today would discuss further economic aid with Panamanian leaders. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the American delegation, headed by Deputy Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger, would focus on developing recommendations to President Bush for assisting Panama's new government. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is composer John Adams. He was once described by conductor Edo DeVart as being in the forefront of a group that believed music didn't have to be ugly to be contemporary. Adams intentionally blurs distinctions between, quote, serious music and pop. His orchestral music has used synthesizers, drum machines, and saxophone quartet, and has alluded to all the music that he's been affected by, including jazz, ragtime, rock, and minimalism. Adams is now best known for his opera Nixon in China, about Richard Nixon's historic visit to the People's Republic in 1972. Adams has lived in San Francisco for about 20 years, where he's taught at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music and led their new music ensemble, and has worked with the San Francisco Symphony as new music consultant and composer in residence. Adams' new record features his new composition, The Wound Dresser, which uses the text of the Walt Whitman poem. The Wound Dresser describes Whitman's experiences nursing wounded soldiers during the Civil War. Adams found the poem to be particularly relevant today, with so many people filling hospital wards suffering from AIDS, and with so many homeless people struggling out on the streets. The poem also had personal relevance for Adams.
I was writing this piece during the final stages of my father's decline into death due to Alzheimer's disease. And I think that particular event and the relationship that went on between my mother, who was caring for him, and him brought home this act of nursing, this act of compassion, which Whitman spoke so eloquently about in the first person.
Before we hear your composition, The Wound Dresser, I'd like for you to read the first stanza of the poem, which is the stanza that we'll be hearing in the excerpt we're going to play.
Bearing the bandages, water, and sponge, straight and swift to my wounded I go, where they lie on the ground after the battle brought in, where their priceless blood reddens the grass, the ground, or to the rows of the hospital tent, or under the roofed hospital, to the long rows of cots, up and down each side, I return. To each and all, one after the other, I draw near. Not one do I miss. An attendant follows, holding a tray. He carries a refuse pail, soon to be filled with clotted rags and blood, emptied and filled again.
Could you just talk a bit about the musical mood that you wanted to convey in the music?
Well, like all of Whitman's poetry, it's in the first person. It's always, I did this, I felt this, I went here, I encountered this person. I actually lopped off the first couple of stanzas of the poem because I felt that they did typify Whitman at his more Victorian, sentimental. And I focused just on the actual event of him walking into the hospital ward, going through those doors, and encountering these rows upon rows of beds of young men, many of whom were dying, and many of whom did die in Whitman's arms. And what I found as a greatest challenge was to find a way to set this graphic portrayal of tending a wounded person. I mean, he does discuss the bandages and the bloody sponges and the pails.
The bloody stumps refuse. He discusses.
He does. He discusses from the amputated arm. I remove the clotted lint, the gnawing and putrid gangrene. These are words that a composer doesn't generally choose to set to musical tones. And I certainly didn't choose them for their shock value. It seems to me that a nurse every day has to deal with these artifacts of biological decay. And we too often shy away from the realities of the body and focus just on the spirit. And what's wonderful about this poem is that the grimness, the hideous reality of the hospital is coupled perfectly with the spiritual transcendence of the act. And I know of no other poem, I know of no other poet who was able to courageously grapple with these two elements.
Well, let's hear the opening of your composition. My guest is John Adams, and this is The Wound Dresser with baritone Sanford Sylvan.
Straight and swift to my wounded I go, where they lie on the ground after the battle brought me. Where their priceless blood reddens the grass, the grass. The hospital tent, or under the roofed hospital, to the long rows of carts, up and down each side I return. To each and all, after another, I draw near. Not one do I miss. An attendant follows, holding a tray. He carries a refuse pail, soon to be filled with clotted rags and blood. Empty and filled again,
John Adams setting for the poem The Wound Dresser, written by Walt Whitman. The baritone was Sanford Sylvan, and my guest is the composer, John Adams. When you were writing the setting for the poem, did you, like, read it over and over to yourself to get to get the line readings that you wanted and the fall of the language?
Yes, I find that the greatest challenge in setting poetry is to capture the way in which the language is spoken. And, of course, American is spoken very differently than English. During the composition of my opera, Nixon in China, I found myself taking walks with my librettist Alice Goodman's texts, and just not memorizing the text, but just saying them over and over again until I got the right lilt, the right rhythmic feel for the words. And I, of course, did this with the Whitman as well.
I want to do something that shows how really different the two musics on your new record are, and that is like, go right to the second composition on your record, which is called Fearful Symmetries, and the mood is absolutely manic on this one. it's going to, you know, when you're listening to it on a CD or a record and they come back to back, it's really quite a sudden shift. Do you think of these two pieces as representing two different but equal sides of your personality as a composer?
Yes. What I've often said, somewhat in jest, is that I've learned to live with the schizophrenic side of my musical personality. And I think probably the greatest moment of liberation for me as a composer was allowing this, particularly this trickster or wacky side of myself to come out.
Okay, this is John Adams, Fearful Symmetries. The opening of Fearful Symmetries, a recent composition by my guest John Adams, who conducted the orchestra of St. Luke's. One of your earlier pieces that was written in, I think, a similar vein was Grand Pianola Music.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read that at its 1983 premiere, people booed it.
And it wasn't the premiere, but it was the second performance. It was at Avery Fisher Hall in New York. The New York Philharmonic played it as part of a festival of contemporary music, much of which was the contemporary music that we often think of. In the midst of all this 12-tone, very dour, grim, serialist music came this piece that had rather vulgar tunes and very glitzy orchestration and strange goings-on in the pianos that sounded a little bit like Rachmaninoff and a little bit like Ferranti and Tyker. And I think it offended a lot of people who felt it such a kind of aggrieved vulgarity shouldn't appear on the programs of the New York Philharmonic.
Well, I was really very impressed when I heard that you were booed, because I think it's very very hard to get that kind of response nowadays, for people to feel so strongly one way or another about something in a concert hall.
Well, not only that, but I think also that the issue of minimalism, which is a style of a musical composition which I work in, is was at that time and still continues to be one of great controversy. People feel that it's a kind of retroactive reduction, a simplification of all the great evolutionary developments of 20th century music. And I don't agree. I think that what the minimalist composers have done is really the only significant stylistic growth to have occurred in new music since World War II.
Well, let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is composer John Adams, and he has a new record that features his compositions Fearful Symmetries and The Wound Dresser. And he's also the composer of the opera Nixon in China. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Composer John Adams is my guest. Now, I know that when you graduated college, your parents gave you a copy of John Cage's book, Silence. And when I heard that, I thought, what very hip parents you must have had.
Well, my mother worked in an art gallery in New Hampshire, and Cage's books were stocked in the gallery. I'm not exactly sure she realized the revolutionary impact of her choice. But nevertheless, it was an important book because it forced me to question a lot of the standard Eurocentric values that had been inculcated in me during my years at Harvard in the study of music. Cage forced me to come out of my cocoon and look at the world around me, also to look at sound from a different point of view. Maybe that's an oxymoron, to listen to sound from a different point of view. And generally, I would have to credit him with the decision on my part to leave the university, come out to San Francisco, which I did in 1971, and basically try to make a living as a composer and stay away from academia and college teaching, which is how most serious composers in this country are able to survive.
Now, I know that you were the first undergraduate at Harvard, was it, to write music as your thesis? Was it hard to convince your professors to accept that? And do you have any regrets about it, or do you really think, looking back, you did the right thing?
Well, first of all, you have to realize that I graduated in 1969, which is the year that most college faculty in the country were being held hostage, either literally or figuratively, by their students. So that year, it was possible to get just about anything done or accomplished. But I think also what the point I was trying to make was that as a composer, my work was creative, and it wasn't research, and it wasn't something that I did by spending countless hours in a library writing a thesis. I made my point, and eventually the programs for composers were developed throughout the country. I'm not saying that I was the leader of this. I'm sure other universities did this first. It's a double-edged sword because, on the one hand, it does allow serious creative activity to take place within the academic environment, but I also think that the academic environment is a very dangerous, possibly even a pernicious one for real creative activity because it is essentially a critical environment. It's one where people basically analyze, and creativity has to have both analysis but also completely intuitive, almost unconscious activity as well. And frequently the university is not the most supportive environment for that.
My guest is composer John Adams. Let's talk a little bit about your recent opera, Nixon in China. And this was the opera was directed by Peter Sellers, who I think originated the idea as well, and approached you to write music for it. And you've said in the past that when he approached you, you thought of, when you thought of like an opera with Richard Nixon in it, you thought of Rich Little and Dan Aykroyd, and you couldn't imagine Nixon singing. And I'd like to know how you got around that feeling of absurdity.
Well, I got around that feeling of absurdity immediately by seeing the libretto by the one person that you haven't mentioned, which is Alice Goodman, who's as much a partner in this as Peter or I. Alice's libretto was, I think, an absolutely brilliant work of art, in that she was able to capture the language of these Americans, particularly these American Republican politicians, in a way that was both very trenchant, very meaningful, but also very funny, very whimsical. And she played that off against a more stilted type of language that the Chinese would speak, which of course is in English, but has that strange arch feeling that translated Chinese has. And also her treatment of Nixon was at once very funny and very human, and also, I think, rather dignified. I mean, no matter how much we thrash the man and make fun of him, there were things about him that were still, nevertheless, visionary.
Let me play a short excerpt of your opera Nixon in China with James Madalena as Nixon, and this is a. Shall we call it an aria, or this is the passage where he sings, "News has a kind of mystery."
Yes, I call it an aria. This is when he steps down off Air Force One and shakes Zhou Enlai's hand for the first time and looks up and sees all the television cameras whirring away.
As a kind of mystery. As a kind of mystery. When I shook hands with Joe and Lai, when I shook hands with Joe and Lai, on this bare field outside Peking, just how the whole world was listening. The whole world was listening.
An excerpt from, I guess, John Adams' opera Nixon in China. Would you ever do an opera again? I imagine you ran into all kinds of, like, staging things and so on that you were really unused to.
Would I ever do an opera again?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think I'm doing
now?
Yes,
dear.
We're deep into the next opera, Alice and Peter and I. It's called The Death of Klinghoffer. And, again, it focuses on a recent contemporary event where the whole world was watching, just as Nixon said in this aria that you just heard here. And we deal, of course, in this case, with the Middle East and the sort of age-old clash of peoples over a small plot of land, and also with another theme, which is similar to Nixon in China, that is of tourists abroad. In a certain way, the Nixon party going to Peking is like a tourist trip. They were tourists going in there and not really knowing what to expect. And it's a similar case with these Americans who were caught on the Achille Lauro when it was hijacked in 1985.
Well, I wish you good luck with your new opera, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
John Adams' new recording of The Wound Dresser and Fearful Symmetries is on Nonesuch. His new opera, The Death of Klinghoffer, is scheduled to premiere in Brussels on March 19, 1991. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, how Mickey Mouse, Betty Boop, and other cartoon celebrities weathered the change from movies to television with animation historian Charles Solomon. Solomon's new history of animation is called Enchanted Drawings. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Mazel tov, mazel tov, Kinder, und für alle sein Gesinn.
Congratulations!
Coming up, Yiddish punchlines, tumblers, Simon Says by the Pool, and bachelor waiters. Stephen Canfer has written a history of New York's Catskill Mountains and the vacation culture created at the mountains' resort hotels. Also, rock historian Ed Ward turns the clock back 10 years for a second look at the year 1980. And book critic John Leonard reviews Good Night by Soviet novelist Andrei Sinyavsky. It's part memoir, part novel, about the life of a dissident. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. 4 days after being sworn into office as president of Czechoslovakia, Václav Havel visited the two Germanys today. Matt Fry of the BBC reports that Havel went first to East Berlin for talks with that country's new leaders before traveling on to West Germany.
President Havel told reporters that as a Czech dramatist, the symbolism of Berlin and Munich did not escape him. It was the crumbling of the Berlin Wall that helped the revolution to flourish in Czechoslovakia. The past was swept away today, thanks to President Havel's good humor. In East Berlin, he told the acting head of state, Manfred Gerlach, that he was amazed the wall was still standing, and that if there were any problems, he would send some Czechoslovak workers, free of charge, to help dismantle it. In Munich, President Havel's discussions with the West German leadership touched on a variety of issues, including economic cooperation and the environment. But by visiting the two Germanys, as opposed to the Soviet Union, the prime purpose of President Havel's visit was a symbolic affirmation of Czechoslovakia's role in a Central Europe without barriers and, as he put it, without fear of a democratic united Germany.
Matt Fry, the BBC. The East German president said today the Berlin Wall will be torn down completely. He did not offer a date, but said that this would happen in the near future. Ben Bradshaw in Berlin has more on the story.
Since the opening of East Germany's borders nearly 2 months ago, a number of new holes have been made in the Berlin Wall to serve as extra crossing points, but most of the 100-mile-long structure still stands. Now President Gerlach says the wall has outlived its usefulness and could be replaced by simple border markings, as is the practice along other boundaries between countries. If the wall does go altogether, it'll raise a number of problems for East Germany over how to enforce currency and customs regulations. Controlling the black market along a border in the middle of a city is a customs official's nightmare and was given as one of the main reasons for the wall's construction in the first place. For National Public Radio, I'm Ben Bradshaw in Berlin.
In efforts to protect the coast of Morocco, helicopters sprayed chemical agents on a 100-square-mile oil slick today. Morocco says about 19 million gallons of crude have come out of a crippled Iranian tanker. But environmental experts say much of the oil has been broken up by high waves and dissolved in the 60-degree seas. A salvage firm says the two leaking chambers of the tanker are now empty, a fact that officials in Morocco dispute. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 57 points, to close at 2,810.15. It was the first ever close above the 2,800 mark. Gainers led decliners by about 3-1 on trading of some 161 million shares. Trading was active. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Today, rock and roll historian Ed Ward wraps up his investigation of the music that was being played 10 years ago, when the decade we just ended had only begun. Ed says that in black music, 1980 offered a clean break from what came before.
Honey, you are my shining star.
1980, the black music industry was congratulating itself on having survived disco with all its traditional values intact. Songs like The Manhattan's Shining Star and Special Lady by another group of harmony vocal veterans named Ray Goodman and Brown, who had once been known as The Moments, made acceptable hits. Not that he was denying that dance music was an integral part of the black music scene. It's just that if you were going to do it, you did it right. Find a superb producer like Quincy Jones and a strong talent like Michael Jackson, and you could sell a lot of albums. Even producers who had come up during the disco era who are now being considered mainstream soul producers, like Chic's Bernard Edwards and Nile Rodgers, who crafted a few 1980 hits for another member of Motown's royal family.
I said, upside down, you're turning me. You're giving love instinctively. Round and round, you're turning me. Upside down. Boy, you turn me.
Edwards and Rodgers didn't know it, but they were about to start a revolution, even though they never got the credit. The roots of that revolution go back a few years earlier to an obscure album, I don't have a copy, by the Fatback Band, on which there appeared a track called King Tim III, a song saluting and co-starring a disco DJ who would rhyme rhythmically over the instrumental breaks in the records he played. In New York, his counterpart was a guy known as DJ Hollywood.
Shock, shock the high! To know just who you've been listening to.
Say what?
I said, listen to me now. Well, I tell you how, who I am and what I do.
Oh, yeah.
I'm 5'9" and a half and bow-legged as you ever wanted to see.
Say what?
Just look over by the music, baby doll. I'm talking about little old me. It's Holly Girl and
Hollywood's
so
record,
glad.
Shock Shock the House, was a monster and should have been a big hit because it was the first waxing of a phenomenon that was getting going in black clubs like Disco Fever in the South Bronx. But the record company only pressed it on a 7-inch single, not the preferred medium in discos. And instead, the hit went to an inferior act on a streetwise independent label.
Now what you hear is not a test, I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. You see, I am Wonder Mike, and I like to say hello. To the black, to the white, the red, and the brown, and the purple, and yellow. But first, I gotta bang, bang, the boogie to the boogie, say up, jump the boogie. The bang bang boogie, let's rock. You don't stop, rock the rhythm that'll make your body rock. Well, so far you've heard my voice, but I brought two friends along. And next on the mic is my man Hank. Come on, Hank, sing that song.
Check it out, I'm the CASN, the OVA, and the rest is FLY.
The Sugar Hill Gang was the invention of Sugar Hill Records, owned and operated by Sylvia Robinson, who'd been half of Mickey and Sylvia in the 50s. The Sugar Hill Gang took one of the most popular disco breaks from Chic's Good Times, looped it, much as a DJ would with his two turntables, and put their rap over it. Rapper's Delight only got to 36 on the pop charts, but its influence was much greater than its sales. It opened up the ears of a lot of black kids who had been watching the action on the street corners, where a DJ with a dual turntable setup would plug into a lamppost while his buddy grabbed a mic and took the sounds of the clubs to the streets. This had been going on ever since a Jamaican kid known as Cool Herc had shown New Yorkers what Jamaican DJs had known for years, that by playing with the sounds on records and coming up with rhymes, you could create a whole new genre of music. And while Cool Herc is lost in the mists of history, his prime disciple, Joseph Sadler, known as Grandmaster Flash, began making records in 1980.
If you want to party, you better get ready to rock, my friend. You see, we got some news
that you can use, and offer that you can't refuse.
We're giving up, honey, and you got to come, because you're the one.
Red, yellow, black, white, or brown, in our own way, or we can all get down.
So just take your time
and enjoy yourself,
and you'll rock as good as anyone else. Now come on, go through it.
As you can hear, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five were well beyond just playing a single record and jabbering over it. The rappers told stories and boasted while Flash cut from record to record, from hits to obscurity. By the end of 1980, rap had become such a fashionable thing that a Bronx street gang, the Zulu Nation, had their own DJ, Afrika Bambaataa, and were giving up on violence to challenge all comers on the mic. Rap? A fad, said the grand old men in the black music industry. It would never last, they said, complacent as Mitch Miller in the face of Elvis. Historic events rarely mark off cleanly into decades, but in 1980, a new era was actually kicking off.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
We rock and don't stop. When it's the supercalifragilistic and fialidosis, mythical stranger, technobagatrices is the way we get our kicks. We're qualifying, rectifying, rocking till the day we die. And every time you scream and cry, we'll be here with no denying. We hold our honor and our pride. To take the steps that kept us fly. Set down roots will apply. We're going to take you for a ride. Before we rock and that's some fun, let's introduce us one by one. I'm Spencer K, I'm on display. I rock the pulse of USA. At least I'll shine a rock and mine, I do it to you every time. Remember me, I'm Zemo D, the man that's at the T.O.P. I'm Spoonie G, as you can see, I rock the world society. And at the end, you will agree, nobody rocks the mic like me. But Spencer K, since I'm on D, yeah, that's a really good three.
This is Fresh Air. In the 1930s and 40s, comedians Danny Kaye, Red Buttons, and Milton Berle got their start performing in the resorts around New York's Catskill Mountains. But back then, they were still David Daniel Kaminsky, Aaron Schwartz, and Milton Berlinger. They traveled a circuit of Jewish hotels that was known as the Borscht Belt. These hotels offered more than respite from the summer heat. Once there, city dwellers spent the time in between meals being constantly entertained by the social director, or as he was better known, the Tummler. In the new book, A Summer World, Stephen Camford traces the history of the Catskill resorts, beginning in 1773 with the arrival of the man known as Jacob the Jew, up to the present. Camford grew up in New York City. I asked him if he ever went to the Catskills as a kid.
I never did, no. I was forbidden the Catskills as a child because...
You were forbidden?
Yes, it was too frivolous in my family. We were a family of Romanian socialists, and you spent the summers... taking care of the poor or founding Zionist states or whatever. You certainly didn't fool around in the Catskills with all those tumblers. And, of course, as a result, I became very curious. I was also forbidden comic books as a child, and as a result, I'm one of the walking experts in comic books. So it really is a case of curiosity of the forbidden.
If you were at one of the high-end resort hotels in the Catskills in the glory days, in the late 40s or in the 1950s, and you were staying, say, at Grossinger's, a Concord, one of the big hotels. What might a typical day and typical night have been like?
Well, first of all, you would obey the Grossinger's law, which is that you shall not draw an unorganized breath. From the time you get up in the morning, your day is fixed. You would be expected to attend three meals, dressed differently for each meal. You would then probably be entertained on the lawn. In the morning, you might play tennis, you might just watch people playing tennis, you might swim, you would have a bathing suit for that, you would certainly have another bathing suit for your afternoon dip, you would have another outfit for your lunch, you would have another outfit for your supper, you would have another outfit for dancing afterwards, you would have another outfit probably for attending the theater, watching the Tummler, or watching a little vest pocket musical. You would probably have a canoeing outfit or a rowboat outfit for your evening relaxation on the lake, and then you'd come back, and because you'd only had three meals with about 500 choices of things, you would retire to your room where you would probably have salamis hanging like stalactites from the ceiling. Most people did.
Describe what the Tummler did at the hotel.
The Tummler would start in the morning by kidding you at breakfast and follow you throughout the day. The Tummler had about 6 hours sleep. The rest of the time he was on. He only knew two states, on and off, like a light bulb. And when he was off, he was asleep. When he was on, he was making sure that couples were constantly changing until they found the right guy or the right girl. He told jokes while you were waiting in line, perhaps for food or waiting to get a rowboat, or when you were doing calisthenics, which he would usually lead. He would tell jokes or stories of one sort or another, usually success stories about a couple whom you just missed last week, who met and got married. He a doctor, she an heiress. You know. Always. They were always just, you just missed those people. That was the success stories. And then at night, he entertained professionally. He was the MC. Sometimes he starred in the musicals. Sometimes he had the lead. Sometimes he had the comic role. And then and at night, sometimes, like Danny Kaye, he entertained in headlights. They turned the cars into a semicircle, and he would entertain in the headlights if there was no nightlights for them.
The Tumbler was like the social director, the entertainment director. What does the word Tumbler mean?
The word Tumbler means what it sounds like. It's a man who creates a tumult. That is to say, he makes sure that no one is ever relaxed in his presence.
One of the things the Tumbler did at all of the Catskill resorts was to lead, Simon Says, usually by the pool or in the lobby. Do you have any idea how this Simon Says institution got started in the Catskills?
Most people feel that what happened was it began as a children's game and then it became a romance game. That is to say, you would do, I think everybody knows what Simon Says is, you just move according to the instructor, and if he doesn't say Simon Says and he says, do this, and you do it, you're out. And he would try to arrange it in one way or another so that in the end, one couple was left on the floor. And then he would say, Simon Says, hug. They would hug, and that was the beginning of many romances. I think that's the way it really began. And the Tumblers, it was a very easy thing for most Tumblers to do. You didn't have to be funny. You just had to get people to move their arms and move their legs. It was a combination of calisthenics and gags. And from there, they moved to telling jokes during the middle of, there's a celebrated Tumbler in Grossinger's who used to tell jokes right in the middle. He would say, do this, do that. A lady asks me about sex. I say, sex, it's a good department store. You know, he'd do those kind of lines in the middle of his routines. And sometimes they worked very well, and sometimes they didn't. In the end, I think, just as in the game itself, there was only one Simon Says game left in the Catskills, and that was indeed at Grossinger's. And now Grossinger's is out of business.
Now, one of the legacies of the Catskill resorts is the comics. I mean, so many comics came up through the ranks of the Catskill clubs.
Well, there was no minor leagues, you know, in the days of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. There were no minor leagues except the Catskills and the smaller nightclubs. And in the Catskills, you had the freedom to fail. Joan Rivers said the Catskill audiences were the worst in the world, the hardest on her. She used to say that she would appear at some resorts where they spoke only Yiddish. She spoke only English. So a translator would come in, and she said every line bombed twice. But nevertheless, she learned. She got tough because of it, and Buddy Hackett learned that way, and Alan King learned that way. The most famous of the Tumblers who made it big was Danny Kaye, who started in a little resort called White Row, and the next thing you know, he was offered an MGM contract. And Jerry Lewis started as really a kid. I think he was 15 or 16 years old at Brown's. And Sid Caesar, who really sponsored a great many humorists, like Woody Allen, who wrote for him, and Mel Brooks, they all began in the Catskills. And they probably hated it, and they certainly never went back, but it taught them what they knew. It taught them an awful lot about timing. Jackie Mason learned everything he knew about timing.
There was a whole subculture of the waiters and busboys at the hotels, and even if you only know the Catskills through Dirty Dancing, you will have picked up on that. How did the waiters end up being the young single guys?
There was never enough single men. There never have been enough single men at any resort anywhere in the world. And so what they used to do, the owners would do, is get waiters, and they would screen them pretty carefully too, who were in college, so that they were presented as, this young man will be a lawyer next year. This young man is going to be a doctor someday. And so the girls would come up, even though these were only waiters, they had somebody to dance with and somebody who has had a future. And for many people, if you really realize how many of the customers were immigrants or the sons and daughters of immigrants, this was the only way they could move socially. They were from Lower East Side background, not very much money, socially at the bottom of the American ladder. And they could marry up, or they could marry somebody who was going up because he was a professional. It was very, very important to have that kind of status. And so all of these waiters and busboys represented a kind of a key to the door, a way out into America, and it worked. It wasn't just a promise. That's why there's really no Borscht Belt anymore, is because people married out of the Borscht Belt and went to college out of the Borscht Belt and traded up from the Borscht Belt.
As a resort area, the Catskills have changed immensely in the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. What were some of the reasons for a lot of the hotels and country clubs closing up?
Well, I've traced it to a few things. One, I think you may doubt this, but it really is true, the invention of the air conditioner, because it meant that summers were not as insupportable. You could stay in the Bronx in July and you wouldn't die, whereas formerly you thought you would. You thought you'd just melt and run down into a sewer. And the other thing is really much deeper and more important, and that is success is what undid the Catskills. For one thing, anti-Semitism subsided. For another, people were able to afford more expensive vacations. You could go to Europe. You could go to Florida. You could even go to Israel. And gradually, the Catskills began to be perceived as something your grandparents or your parents did. You didn't want to do that. So the Catskills is really undone by success. It is very much an American story of assimilation and integration into American life.
Mm-hmm. When it was clear that the clientele wasn't coming like they used to the Catskill resorts, what are some of the changes that the owners made to try to attract more customers?
There are two things I could tell you about. One was, of course, Italian night, which is always shocking to me. I mean, the idea that they would have Polish and polka nights and other things. But one of the things that sort of surprised me, I went to the Concord in doing some research on the book, and the first thing I saw, this is the Concord has a place that has a synagogue built right within it, and I went inside, and there on sort of a black felt sign, you know, with the movable white letters, it said, "Welcome, Blue Shield, Blue Cross." And that, to me, said it all. I mean, these are now resorts that cater largely to conventions of businessmen and sales forces and the like. So that's what they've tried to do. They've tried to make it a convention business, no longer the simple Jewish nuclear family. They can't make it simply on that. The few that are still surviving.
So if you go to the Catskill resorts now, what else are you going to see?
You'll see ethnics of one sort or another. You will see Hasids. You will see blacks. You will see Hispanics. You'll see a very different kind of resort. This isn't to say that there are no Jews up there. The Jews have settled in the towns. You'll see Jewish police chiefs and Jewish firemen and Jewish store owners and administrators of all kinds. But you're not ever going to see, I think, the old kind of Jewish resort again, because those people, except perhaps for the influx of Russian Jews that are coming to the United States now, those people are gone. They're into American life.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Stephen Kanfer is the author of A Summer World. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.
Now's no time for schluffen schepsel, drink lachayim, nema schnepsel, listen to that Mendel blow. Number four and away we go!
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll be hearing today from Berlin, where Czechoslovakian President Václav Havel made his first official visit. We'll also be speaking with a woman who lives outside Warsaw about the impact of economic reform in Poland. Prices are starting to skyrocket. Her home heating bill, she tells us, will go up five times what they were last year. We'll hear how she and others plan to cope with that. Also, a report by science reporter Wendy Schmelzer today about language acquisition and young children. Some findings that might change the way parents deal with newborns.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Good Night is a fictionalized memoir by the dissident Soviet writer Andrei Sinyavsky, who now lives and writes in Paris. Sinyavsky wrote Good Night under the name of Abram Terts in the early 80s. The book has just been published here by Viking Penguin. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
When Andrei Sinyavsky was arrested by the KGB in 1965, his crime against the Soviet state was fiction. He'd smuggled this fiction abroad to be published under the pseudonym of Abram Terts. Abram Terts is a Jewish name. Sinyavsky isn't Jewish. His choice of alter egos is no less mysterious than everything else about this remarkable writer. During his 7 years in a labor camp, he seems always to have consulted his alter ego on how to behave. Terts, an invented identity, was streetwise, tough, brave, and principled, unlike Sinyavsky, according to Sinyavsky. In Russia, to be Jewish is to be automatically dissident. Sinyavsky prefers to believe that everything that happened to him personally was by accident or chance, that he stumbled on the history of his time and place and was punished for it. But if he chooses to be chosen, he invites a martyrdom that might make some sense. This, of course, is just my guess. When a writer of fiction invents another writer of fiction to write the fiction he thinks he ought to be writing, the situation is Nabokovian. Good Night, a novelized memoir, or autobiographical novel, or series of essays on memory, clears up no confusions. Written in Paris, to which he was exiled after he got out of the labor camp, and published under both his names, Good Night is a wheel of stories with five spokes. I don't know why he begins with his arrest and interrogation, and then reports his annual meetings with his wife in a prison dorm, and then retreats to think about his father, who'd been a social revolutionary hated by the Bolsheviks, and then advances a bit to dissect the character of a lifelong acquaintance, a charming poet and ugly careerist, only to retreat again to berate himself for his complicity in a KGB plot to compromise an innocent Western woman. It seems to me that all these stories would have been better off in chronological order. But it's his wheel, and he spins it, as if at roulette. And whenever he wants to, he stops to stick in some fiction or a play to improve the action. And each spoke is an arrow in the brain. By slang and jokes and witty references to every Russian writer we've ever heard of, and some we haven't, he presses his material to its watermark, the hidden design, a brilliant figure in a bloody carpet. We're shocked by his father's madness. We're terrified by Stalin's ghost. We wonder if the careerist poet is really Yevtushenko. We dream in history and literature, and we begin to suspect that Sinyavsky was chosen after all to write this prayer wheel of a book. After his arrest, old friends refuse to speak to his wife. Former comrades cross the street to avoid her. But a stranger left a chicken on her doorstep. Was it poisoned? His wife ate the chicken. It wasn't poisoned. Sinyavsky tells us, that chicken, carried straight from a deep freezer to our door in some enchanted briefcase, was a bit of Charles Dickens, a Hans Christian Andersen story. Say what you will, I measure from my own front door. You can die, and no one will hear you cry out. There was never any goodness in the world, and there is none now. But someone came and placed a chicken at our doorstep. And so, another Russian genius. On your doorstep, for Happy New Year, I wish you a chicken.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Good Night by Andre Sinyavsky. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tui and Roberta Shorrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, from Mickey Mouse through Bugs Bunny to The Simpsons, Charles Solomon gives us the history of animation. And Eddie Gorodetsky tells us how he plans to keep us laughing 24 hours a day. He's the head writer for HBO's new comedy channel. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.